Today on Rockin' the Suburbs,
we pay tribute to two lost legends.
Bye-bye, loves. All right, sad news this week, Patrick, with the passing of two legendary musicians.
Yep.
Don Everly of the Everly Brothers and Charlie Watts of the Rolling Stones, both passed away in their 80s. And I think both are very worthy of us discussing a bit today.
Totally, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
I think we should start with Don Everly because, first off, you know, just that was the news first.
Yep.
And then also, I kind of feel like the Everly brothers don't quite get the appreciation that maybe they deserve for really how influential they were. And I know you can speak to that, but I will just say real quickly that probably the most famous case of influence with the Everly brothers would be the Beatles, right? Because they admitted it early on that they developed, you know, the Lennon-McCartney vocal harmonies were based on the Everly brothers. And you can hear it right from the beginning in like Please Please Me, for example. And then when you hear a song, you know, just a little bit later, I would point to a song like If I Fell, which I think not only just has those harmonies, but just kind of the whole sound of the song sounds like it could be an Everly Brothers song, you know, that sort of folk rock sort of, you know, feeling to it. And then just sort of those lilting vocals, it really shows, I think, the impact that they had. But let's talk about the Everly Brothers music, you know, their own music themselves, right? You know, they were an act in the 50s, you know, with the sort of first wave of rock and roll. They were out of Nashville. Which was an interesting juxtaposition with, you know, a lot of that music coming out of Memphis, right?
Yep.
But what do you think of the music that they actually produced?
Well, I think that it was, you know, extremely influential, like you said, Jim. But also, you know, to me, when you think about the Everly Brothers, they were able to do kind of everything that was happening in the 50s and early 60s rock and roll style wise, right? You know, they could have a fast up-tempo song like Bye Bye Love, right?
Yep.
And yet they could do All I Have to Do is Dream or Kathy's Clown, you know, that were heartbreaking. They were able to, you know, kind of encapsulate so much that was happening that they set the stage, like you said, for not only the Beatles, you know, who absorbed all their styles and all their ways of playing and then began to build on that, but also people like the Beach Boys, right, who took harmonies and built on them. And also, for me, I think a lot of Simon and Garfunkel, too, because, you know, that's another direction that their music was taken in a much more sensitive, you know, and that became all the rage on college campuses in the 60s, mid 60s and later 60s, right? Was that kind of sensitive feeling they could do. And maybe Paul Simon added, you know, some lyrics that were more introspective, maybe than what the Everly Brothers came up with. But, again, building on what they had done, and they wholly absorbed that style. I mean, you know, and the Everly Brothers were touring and playing, you know, on these package dates with everybody, every, you know, 50 star you could think of, from Elvis all the way down. And so they really were totally complete, you know, rock and rollers and also folk musicians and also balladeers. So it's kind of incredible how great they were in their time.
They were. They were. And I think, I'm glad you mentioned Simon and Garfunkel. I was going to get to that too. The other thing, besides just their vocal contributions, I think their guitar playing was really influential too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they stuck to the acoustic guitars, I think, for the most part, but they played them with such, like you said, they could also play that kind of up-tempo style.
Yeah.
But played on the acoustic, which gave it this really cool, what we would think of now is maybe like Americana sort of sound, right? You know?
True. Yeah, very
true. It was so cool. And I think of a song like Wake Up Little Susie, right? And it just has that, it just has a great sort of like guitar part to it. You know, that song is a little bit more of a beat, closer to maybe a rockabilly kind of song, right? But it's just got that great acoustic guitar part. And then I compare that to like Mrs. Robinson, right? Same kind of thing. You know what I mean?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's interesting. I mean, the Everly Brothers started out playing in a band with their family. You know, their dad was a very gifted guitar player and singer, and he moved the family to Chicago to try to establish them as one of those family acts. And it wasn't, you know, it was when in the early 50s when rock and roll started coming in and live radio performances, you know, began to fade, you know, as the main way to transmit music, that the brothers went out and sought their own fortune on their own. You know, you never know. They could have been a family act, right, for the whole time. So it was kind of interesting the way that developed.
I think in terms of the, you know, the really iconic early rock and roll stars, you know obviously there's Elvis and there's Chuck Berry and there's Little Richard and there's Jerry Lee Lewis, right? And you know, Buddy Holly, right?
Yeah.
And there's the Everly Brothers, and I think the Everly Brothers belong, you know, right there with them. They were first class inductees into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, for whatever that matters, but what it means is that the people who put that together realized, you know, this inaugural class, we've got to have the heavyweights in there, and the Everly Brothers were one of them, right? And so, but I don't think, I for whatever reason, I think they, over time, fell out of favor. Maybe their sound kind of seemed sort of dated, like your parents' music, whatever. You know, it didn't have that kind of, for a while, because it was so, like, acoustic-based, it didn't have that sort of cool factor to it. Although I think that's come back around. I think if you listen to it now, it sounds really cool, you know? But,
I think so.
But I think they were always, even when maybe they sort of fell out of public favor, or they, you know, became an oldies act or whatever, they were always admired by musicians, right? Always.
Always.
Throughout time, you know? And I even think of, like, you know, a guy like John Doe loves the Everly Brothers, right? You know, there was just, they were sort of musicians, I think, to a large extent as well.
Totally. And two things I'll say. One, you know, I think they were so, at least to my mind anyway, the way I think about it, they were so strongly linked with that first wave of rock and roll that we talked about, that when things started happening with the Beatles and British Invasion and the Byrds and you know, all that in the 60s and late 60s, even though they tried to adapt, they I think were just so strongly linked to that, that part of their career never really, you know, took off. And, you know, for better or worse, that's just kind of the way I think, you know, they were perceived. The other thing I'll point out too is if folks haven't heard, they have an album called Songs Our Daddy Taught Us. And it was late '50s, I think 59 or so. And it's a country album. And it really is kind of those early songs that they play. But listen to that if you've never heard that part of the early Everly Brothers. Cause again, they mastered that style completely too. You know, that country roots that a lot of, you know, that, you know, like you said, those early rock and rollers, you know, had Jerry Lee Lewis and Elvis and all that, had that, you know, country element, but the Everly Brothers mastered that as well. And that's a great example of it, I think.
Down in the willow garden, where me and my love did meet, as we said a chorus, my love fell off to sleep. I had a bottle of burgundy wine. My love, she did not know. So I poisoned that dear little bird.
And of course, Phil Everly died in 2014.
Uh huh.
The younger, actually, of the two Everly brothers, and rest in power now, Don Everly.
Yeah, rest in power. They're back together again up there in Rock and Roll Heaven. So they will be on those package shows up there now. So that's good.
Okay, now what do you have to say about Charlie Watts? This is a tough one for me because he's such an enigmatic person and character in rock and roll history, but I think hugely important, right? And I think you're seeing sort of an outpouring of tributes that are happening for Charlie Watts, even though he was this guy who was like really quiet in a loud rock and roll band, right? Give me your initial thoughts on Charlie Watts.
Well, I mean, I always think of Charlie Watts as, you know, a lover of jazz who sort of adapted himself to the blues and what the early Rolling Stones were doing, right? He was in Alexis Korner's band. I forget the exact name of it before he was in the Stones. And he was kind of this, you know, very accomplished drummer. And they were playing, you know, kind of a trad jazz style, right? That was also kind of popular in England in the early 60s. And the Stones needed a drummer and they knew he was like the accomplished guy. And Charlie Watts listen to blues music from records to try to absorb how to do that. But in so doing, I think he hit upon this, you know, this style and this approach that was minimalist and focused on the rhythm and focused on holding things together. And of course, when you're playing with Keith Richards and Mick Jagger and Wyman and early on, of course, Brian Jones was very experimental and very psychedelic. And he hit on this style that, you know, that was about holding things together. And one thing that immediately, jumped to my mind when you informed me yesterday that, Charlie had passed. I always go back to my favorite book on the Stones. I probably mentioned it too much on this podcast, but Stanley Booth wrote a book called The True Adventures of the Rolling Stones that focuses on 1969 and also covers their entire career up to that point. It's really the best Stones book I've ever read. And there's a part in here where after their entire U.S. tour and playing a big festival in Miami, the Stones famously went to Muscle Shoals Sound Studio, unannounced to anybody, snuck in there. They didn't pay anybody for anything. And they recorded a couple of songs in there. And was basically, they would start at, you know, sundown and go all the way up until the morning. And on the second night, there's a part in here that Stanley Booth writes, it's 7 o'clock in the morning. And everyone is still in the studio. The engineers are asleep and Keith, Stanley and Mick and Charlie are really the only ones left awake. And I think, for Stanley, Mick and Keith, it was artificial stimulants that had kept them awake to that point. But, he writes, and I quote, Charlie had left the control room and now at 7 o'clock in the morning was sitting alone in the studio playing the drums, pounding away. Now there's a rock and roller, Keith said. So anytime Keith Richards calls you a rock and roller, that's probably the highest compliment you could ever have. But even after an entire tour, two straight nights of recording for 12 or 14 hours, all Charlie Watts wanted to do was go out in the studio by himself and play his drums. I mean, he just, you know, loved to be back there behind his drum kit. And if it wasn't for him, I think the Stones would have flown apart. You know, blown apart in so many different directions many, many times, but he was always there, the anchor to keep them grounded and keep that heartbeat, of so many different songs, that he had.
It's hard to appreciate him. And this is the thing about drummers and I'm not a drumming expert, but you know, there's kind of two camps in the drumming world, right? There's the ones who like the drummer should, be a featured part of the band from time to time, and then there's the ones who say the drummer's real job is to sort of blend in and not call attention to himself, right?
Exactly.
And Charlie Watts was in that second camp, but that does not diminish his efforts at all. In fact, in some ways it may heighten them, because he, like you said, he was the guy who kind of held it together, which was so important for the Stones, because they played in that very loose style, you know. And so his jazz background, even though he didn't play necessarily those exact, you know, kind of beats he might if he was playing jazz, right? But there was enough of that influence in there that it really worked, and it felt like a combo in some way, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And yep. I was thinking of a song like Dead Flowers, right?
Yeah.
Like Dead Flowers, it has a certain like swing to that song, right? That is just so important. Not swing like like you think of, like, you know, big band kind of swing, but
right,
but, you know, but swing in like terms of like feeling, you know.
Yes.
You know, countless examples of that when you listen to the Stone songs. Not a lot of flash. He tended to stay on the snare drum. He didn't do a lot with the toms other than, you know, the fills at the appropriate time. So not a flashy drummer, but man, was there ever a drummer who had better feeling for rock and roll? I'm not sure you could think of one, right?
I don't know if you could. No, not certainly one who played on so many influential records,
right,
and in so many different styles. And you know, we were talking yesterday and kind of messaging in our little friends group too, talking about the song Moonlight Mile, where he kind of plays hard and soft at the same time, you know, and it starts with those washes on the cymbals as the song's coming in, and then it's almost like thunder, you know, that he's playing in the distant thunder in the background at times, the way he holds that whole thing together.
We'll be right back.
You mentioned Let It Bleed is another great example of nothing super flashy, nothing, you know, like nothing Keith Moon-like or anything, but, you know, he was never one to flip his sticks up in the air or do any of that stuff. Right. But yeah, you know, he held it together and the feeling that you got from it is incredible. And without him, you know, I just think so much of that stuff would have slid and, you know, Keith would have just slouched off into oblivion, you know, or and just kind of oozed away, but Charlie was always right there to pick it back up for the turnaround and the next verse or the chorus, and it's stunning, really.
Yeah, it's funny. A couple of things I want to say. So you mentioned, you know, that there were occasions where Charlie would get his chance to get the spotlight a little bit. Another song I think of that just wouldn't be the same without the drums. The drums are kind of prominent in this song. Is Paint It Black?
Yes.
And you mentioned Bitch was another one earlier on, right? Like, these are songs that, like, are definitely powered by the drums, but not in that bombastic way that sort of at the same time and definitely later became the style for rock music for big, you know, rock star bands. So, you know, he was not Keith Moon. He was not John Bonham. He was not Ginger Baker. He's closer to Ginger Baker maybe in this sort of the jazz influence, right? But he wasn't that big bombastic drummer, but when needed to, like I would point to Paint It Black, he could definitely move the song along with some power, but it was like a, but it was a quiet power and still, you know, right?
Yeah, it really was. And I was also thinking too of, and I saw it written in one of the many, many appreciations that are out there on Get Your Ya-Ya's Out, which is the album that was recorded on that 1969 tour. There's even a part in one of the songs where Mick Jagger says to the audience, "Boy, Charlie's good tonight, isn't he?" You know, and they always knew where he was and had to count on him when they flew off in whatever direction for him to be there to catch him and keep, you know, like you said, powering them, the engine behind that propulsion that was the Stones. And that's why, you know, Keith and whoever it was playing that other guitar, whether it was Ron Wood or Mick Taylor or Brian Jones, could hang their decorations on his solid backbeat.
Yep, totally. I also think it's important to note that he really locked in with Keith too. Most drummers, from my understanding, try to like lock in with the bassist, but in this case, it was more drums and rhythm guitar were sort of at the foundation of the songs, right?
Yep. Yep.
And they had a real kinship, you know? I think they just felt the songs the same way. And if you think of, you know, if you think of Mick Jagger as the heart of the Rolling Stones and then Keith Richards as the soul, it's like Charlie's the second soul. You know what I mean? It's like,
exactly.
You know, they just really seem to groove together, and that groove is so important to those Stone songs, you know, so important.
Right, and that just that groove that they developed over all those years, and you know, folks, it wasn't like the Rolling Stones, you know, from gosh, I don't know, you know, I mean, to me anyway, and no offense to anybody who likes, you know, 90s Stones and past that, but
it's a different,
you know,
band
there wasn't
a,
there wasn't a whole lot, you know, that was interesting to me about all that stuff. But, you know, when they played those tours and it was all set up and they were jetting from place to place in limos, man, in 62 and 63, they played almost every single night and rode in the back of an unheated van, you know, right, in the darkness of England. And that just developed, you know, that constant playing and playing, that groove and that soul and that feeling, you know, just developed. And I do want to say before we wrap up this that, and I've saw this two or three different places, but, you know, the legendary story, I think, needs to be retold.
Okay.
One time is about Mick Jagger referring to Charlie Watts as my drummer, quote unquote.
Right.
And Charlie punching him in the face and saying, you're my singer. I'm not your drummer.
Right. Right.
You know, that kind of says it all in many ways.
I love that story. It's such a great story because it seems so out of character from what we know of Charlie Watts. And that was the last point I was going to make is music aside, just purely from a personality standpoint.
Yeah.
Again, not Keith Moon, right? you know?
Yeah.
But also not Jagger and Richards. Like, he always seemed to be the calming influence in the band, that story aside, right? Because apparently he could rise up when he needed to. But you know, for a band that was so notoriously like Bad Boys, right? He seemed to be that guy who maybe was the adult in the room most of the time. And you probably needed that because, you know, again, music aside, the band could have fallen apart many different ways just from their personalities, right?
Oh, yes.
And we know.
Oh, God, yeah.
Jagger and Richards were, you know, fighting and famously didn't get along or whatever. Apparently, Charlie was, like, the apolitical one. Could get along with everyone in the band, you know?
That's it. Yeah, yeah.
And it was because
he was
the
one they could all bitch to him about the other guy. Yeah. You know, totally. Yeah.
You know, a friend of mine pointed out that, you know, around the time we were young and probably, like, first getting into the Stones, this video for Start Me Up would play on MTV, right?
Yeah.
And in that video, if you go back and rewatch it, of course you see Mick and Keith and Ron Wood, and they're all sort of dancing around and just being goofy, right, in this sound stage, right? And then every once in a while the camera cuts to Charlie playing the drums and he's just kind of smiling, back there smiling, right? And it's like a smile of amusement, I think, as much as anything too, like, look at these guys, you know?
Right. Yeah. Right. They're still acting like this. Yeah, yeah. It's kind of incredible. Yeah. That bemusement really, really fits him well. Yeah. And what an incredible life he led. I mean, just amazing. Amazing.
Yeah. With the same band for 58 years.
Unreal.
And the joke is always that, you know, bands cycle through drummers, you know, all the time. Right.
Exactly. And, they explode.
That's right. Charlie, rock solid. So
yeah, unreal. And you know, added to the list, another person that I never thought Keith Richards would outlive.
Well, there's that too.
Yeah, unreal.
Well, among all the Rolling Stones, Bill Wyman, who's older included, this is only the second to pass
original. Yeah, it's incredible, right? Yeah,
so
the world's most dangerous rock and roll,
you know,
band.
And that first was kind of incredible. Famous very young death. So
that's
so
right.
Interesting. Yeah. The longevity
really
of the Rolling
is.
Stones is kind of unbelievable. So
stunning. Yeah. Yeah. Shows rock and roll's good for you.
Yeah.
Keeps you
that's
living
right.
a long life.
There you go, kids. All right. Rest in power, Charlie Watts.
Rest in power, Charlie.
All right. But if anyone would like to share stories or their remembrances or that sort of thing on the Everly Brothers or Charlie Watts,
yeah,
we'd love to hear it. You can call, leave a message, 612-440-1984. Yep. Or you can write us an email, rock@suburbspod.com. Or, of course, there's our Facebook or Twitter or Instagram at Suburbs Pod. Okay. Let's get out of here. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
And I'm Patrick Foster.
We'll talk to you later.
Bye-bye, my love, goodbye. There goes my baby with someone new. She sure looks happy, I sure am blue. She was my baby till he stepped in. Goodbye to romance that might have been. Bye. I think I'm gonna cry.